Welcome back to Insights Unlocked. In this week's episode, User Testing's CEO, Andy McMillan, talks with David Rose, CEO of Lookout, the AI camera system for safe navigation on the water. David is an award-winning, six-time entrepreneur, futurist, and pioneer in integrating technology into everyday life. Andy and David discuss augmented reality's role in enhancing those daily interactions, and what UX designers and product leaders should consider as they build those experiences. Join us as we delve into how seamlessly embedded technology can transform our environments and make the digital feel as natural as the furniture in your living room. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Insights Unlocked, an original podcast from User Testing, where we bring you candid conversations and stories with the thinkers, doers, and builders behind some of the most successful digital products and experiences in the world, from concept to execution.
Welcome to the Insights Unlocked podcast. I'm Nathan Isaacs, Senior Manager for Content Production at User Testing, and joining us today as host is User Testing's CEO, Andy McMillan. Welcome, Andy.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest today is David Rose. David is a six-time award-winning entrepreneur across a range of industries from healthcare to toys to tech. He's an international speaker, patent holder, MIT researcher, and the author of two books, Enchanted Objects, which was about the Internet of Things, and Supersight, about augmented reality and its role in our lives. And he's the CEO of Lookout, the AI camera system for safe navigation on the water. Welcome to the show, David.
Andy, it's really great to be here. I'm excited to be with you both and have this conversation today.
Excellent. Yeah, as Nathan highlighted, you really have an incredible history in tech, product development, and design. Your work has been featured in the Museum of Modern Art, the New York Times, and the Daily Show, which is a pretty amazing combination of places to have your work featured. So can you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspires you through all these endeavors and how all that has led to your involvement with Lookout?
Sure. I guess I'm fascinated by new technology and kind of what user experiences those technologies provide. But my aim is always to kind of create things that feel natural and like they were meant to be there all along because they're kind of part of the furniture or fabric of your life. So early in my career, I worked with Lego on inventing Lego Mindstorms, which was, you know, taking Lego bricks and embedding technology and sensors and motors and Lego bricks, those we all love. And then Guitar Hero, where we took the regular form of a guitar and made it into a video game. So embedding technology and medication packaging, I invented a product called Glow Caps, which was for people to take your meds every day. But we intentionally didn't make it an app. We made it an IoT product where all you have to do is take off the cap and it senses and triggers a bunch of services, but it looks like a regular old, everyday object that you have in your life. So I'm fascinated by changing lighting to make it more sensate, or light switches, or coffee tables, or just the stuff that's around us, car dashboards, etc., clothing, in order to stitch more technology into that in a way that's useful and services us.
I think that whole area of exploration is super interesting when you think about the amount of technology and the rate at which technology is being developed, and I think AI is going to accelerate that massively. But then you think about the touch points and how does the average person interact with that technology. I think your example of the medication is a great one, which is, when somebody's trying to take their medication, I don't think they're trying to have an in-app experience. I think they're just trying to get through doing a thing that they need to get done. But how can technology help them? And I want to connect this into my next question, which is, you have said that designers need to learn a new set of tools for sort of working and creating in what sort of framed as spatial computing, this idea of kind of the real world, if you will, and that the UX for that will be very different than the mobile tools we're accustomed to. And you gave a couple of great examples there. Our audience is a wide variety of people that work across marketing and product development, but we have a lot of folks that are UX designers and UX researchers. So can you tell us a little bit more about what do you mean by the sort of new set of tools and new way of thinking when it comes to spatial computing?
Yeah, well, when I wrote, the most recent book is Enchanted Objects, which I wrote, Enchanted Objects was my first book. The most recent book is called Supersight. And I'm thinking especially about how do we kind of distribute content and experiences that are in the physical world all around us. And the end of the book includes a set of design principles for spatial computing. And I think that in some ways kind of captures what some of the things are that UX designers need to consider when, you know, when designing AR experiences or VR experiences. And it usually has to do with kind of augmenting things that are tangible in the world. So if you want, you know, an example that I use for one of the design principles is there's a company called Curascope that where you kids put on a t-shirt and it's basically like a QR code, and then holding your phone up shows you the insides of the circulatory system and the respiratory system for the kid. But by not just having it be kind of a disembodied 3D model, but instead having it be physically embodied, so you hold up your phone and it looks like you can see the open chest of the person. You know, you're anchoring something into the context of, you know, literally the inside of the chest. So that's just one of the, 12 design principles around how to think about spatial computing and kind of whether the problem that you're solving kind of deserves to be a spatial problem, a spatial computing problem, or whether it's something that would just be fine as a screen or an app or an audio experience.
One of the examples that you walked through in one of the talks you gave online, I thought was really interesting as well, which was this idea of tagging and like imagine a world where there's sort of smarts everywhere. And I think this is really an interesting design pattern for UX professionals to think about. We tend to leap straight to VR often. I feel like in our industry of, you put a headset on and you're in a completely different universe. And while that's certainly very interesting, I think the idea of an augmented reality, and the example you gave that I was referencing was being in a cocktail party, and imagine if you knew everybody's name and you knew a little something about them. Mm-hmm. And it just got me thinking about how different would that make the party? Like you could find people more easily that had things that you thought were interesting. A lot of the awkwardness of not meeting somebody for the first time, but that, do I know this person? You always have that when you go to like a school function, like, I think I've met this person before. Is it going to be awkward if I try to figure that out?
Yeah.
It really would change that dynamic. And you could imagine something as simple as that environment. Everything changes when you can sort of augment it. And I think that's a really powerful concept, maybe connected to this product you're working on now in Lookout, which is really this incredible augmented reality strategy of helping people when they're navigating the waters on a boat. And so maybe tell us a little bit about how that idea came about and sort of why augmented reality is such a powerful concept, maybe in general, to even think about something like just going out on your boat for a nice day on the water and how technology could really make that a much safer and better experience.
Yeah, so the book kind of divides up use cases for spatial computing into 12 chapters. And the first chapter is about kind of the consequences of a world that's more labeled and more intelligible and navigable. And so in some ways, like this business called Lookout, which is just trying to help people who are out in the water get oriented, figure out which way is home in the fog, for example, and then also see the kind of signage that you would see in the world. So in the world, you would have a road sign that says construction zone or shallow area or after a storm, it might say debris, like floating debris in the area. But there's no real way to put signs on the water surface. Like, what do you do? Like, you would float the signs out there and anchor them, and after a storm. Like, so there's a real need for information, and it's a more unstructured environment, but there's no real practical way of putting that information in that environment and helping people with kind of navigational cues. So we are building a camera system that sits high on the boat and then superimposes that kind of signage or augmentation, like safe passage tracks, highlights on other boats you don't want to hit, who's got the right of way, who's crossing over your path. So it really makes the kind of water world intelligible. And rather than wearing AR glasses, which aren't really available yet for boaters that are bright enough and waterproof enough, we're just putting that data on the screen that's at the helm of most boats. So we're working with some boat brands, trying to make it a standard kind of safety feature that works on your Garmin or your Raymarine or your other standard display that's on boats.
Very cool and incredibly useful, and I'm sure we'll do a lot for water safety, because again, in the video I watched, you really highlight there's a bunch of things that come up when you're boating, and it's the ability to sort of highlight that for folks is really powerful.
Yeah, it's dangerous actually out there. I mean, compared to driving, it's kind of 13 times more dangerous per hour. And you know, people really need eyes in their back of their heads and a bird's eye view when docking and the ability to see shallows and spot logs. There's a big benefit.
Yeah, a lot of people are pretty bad drivers, and there's a lot of structure to that. So I can only imagine those folks being out on a boat. So yeah, I think that's much needed. So in your book, Supersight, you also mention some types of AR, I think you call them hazards, which I thought was a good framing, six of them. Can you tell us a little bit about the six AR hazards and what we should be considering when we work in AR?
Yeah, absolutely. So they are the hazards, and I also try to take a crack at how we might address this hazard. You know, so not only do I want to be alarmist, but I also want to be, you know, propose some kind of ways through the forest. So one is social isolation. Let me just read them, and then I'll talk about social isolation a little bit. So social isolation is one. State of surveillance is the next one. Cognitive crutches is the next one. Like if you're using these tools, maybe you won't be as good at cocktail parties if you don't have the exquisite cocktail party host AR feature at the top, you know, that shows you what you share in common with this other person. Another one is the kind of ad model, which is the thing that's probably going to subsidize the $1,000 hardware is some sort of persuasive engine. So the pervasive persuasion is another one of the hazards. Another one is training bias, and another one is super sight for some. So the kind of the social inequity problems of people with and without these tools. But the one that I really wanted to highlight, I don't know if what your experience was with the Vision Pro from Apple, but you know, I did get it and I did send it back. I will admit, and I think the biggest reason was I just didn't feel like it was good for my marriage and my relationship with my kid, because even though it's making a couple of moves towards trying to make it a social experience by projecting, you know, your eyes on the front of it so people can tell that you're looking at them or what state you're in, I still found it was, really destroyed the common media experience that I could have at the end of the day with my kid. I felt like it was, for all of the potential of bringing people together around an object or an artifact or an experience from, you know, a remote kind of teleportation perspective, it mostly was a media consumption tool that isolated me. So was that your experience?
Yeah, I think that's right. I remember trying one of the early Meta headsets, and there was a Netflix at the time had an app where you could watch a Netflix movie, and it was like you're in a movie theater. But the weird part was you're in an empty movie theater and you're the only person in there, which I'm not really sure is, like, I don't think I would pay extra to sit in a movie theater by myself if that was offered by AMC. I think I'd want to sit with the people in the movie theater. So, which is maybe different than when I'm on an airplane, which might be the right use case, which is I often don't want to be sitting with the people with me on the airplane. So maybe that's where VR will really take off. But I think that's right. I think there's and again, we're back to maybe the main thesis here, which is that's not really about the tech. That's about where the tech sort of meets people and humanity and your life and your family and sort of what I hear you saying in that is you sort of want it more integrated in how you want your family life to work, not disintermediating you from your family, which is maybe where these headsets are currently at.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope that the glasses that we all wish for are are coming soon that don't have this social isolation or insulation problem. What I propose is that if you have a different set of AR filters than I have, that there would be an easy bump gesture to kind of see what your filters, what your lenses look like, and you could see what my lenses look like, so we could kind of quickly swap personalization filters as a way of feeling less isolated and more kind of share ability, more able to share our context with each other.
Yeah, it sort of starts to act as an interface for finding common ground, which is maybe not something most of our technology does these days. I feel like a lot of technology these days is sort of driving engagement through frustration. So maybe that's a nice world we can get to. I want to bring in one of your other experiences because I think it's very interesting to share with our audience. When you were at Warby Parker, you were involved in some creative projects about reinventing things like how eye exams were done. But also, I think most of us remember Warby Parker as being one of the first companies that sort of let you sort of virtually try things on. You could bring your look into the environment mixed with something you might purchase. So whether, you know, we're talking about Lookout, your current app with the boating safety we talked about, or Warby Parker, how do you think user experience and customer insights are going to shape how products are developed? I mean, how did it shape those products being developed? How should people think about user insights as part of developing products? And how do we get that right?
Well, I think one of the insights that happened at Warby Parker when we were doing the virtual try-on app is at first, our first instinct was to kind of make it a separate experience. And then we realized that the best way to use it was to make it episodic. So something that could just be a feature of something else that people were already doing. So you have this catalog on your phone of potential frames that you might like, and we made it something where you just it just says, you know, pull down this card in order to see yourself wearing these glasses, and that would trigger the phone, the front-facing camera, it would put the glasses you're wearing on your, you know, on your face. But then we still left like a little tip of the card that was the product listing below. So it was kind of easy to get into it and get out of it. It didn't promise too much. You know, many people used it and loved it and would share it on social media. But they would come into the store and they would say, well, these are the ones I tried online, and here's my dance card for what I want to see actually on my face. And so I think all of that to me kind of made me understand that as a experienced designer, we really need to have kind of a humility about the AR experience won't be everything. You'll still have other browsing experiences, and people at the end of the day will still want to go into the store and still want to share selfies of themselves with their friends even after they go to the store in order to make a decision about glasses. And so, you know, it's a part of a customer journey. It's a part of what I call multi-channel zigzag, where you're like, you want to try it in real life, and then you want to try it online, and then maybe back to real life before you make a decision. And I think we can see that happening across lots of other product categories too, like furniture and jewelry and other things where you can virtually try it on. Landscaping. I was working with a company called Home Outside doing kind of hold up your phone in your yard and see all the new trees as they're planted, and then 2 years later. But I think it's just a component of the path to a decision process.
So when you are sort of imagineering these ideas, these are really interesting concepts. Do you and your teams start with sort of reimagining how a problem could be solved, and then you look for technology that helps you solve the problem? Or I feel like sometimes with these advancements, the tech can get way out in front of how we apply it to problems. And so do you sometimes start with tech and say, what are interesting problems I could solve with this tech? So are you tech-led? Are you problem-led? Does it sort of vary? Do you sometimes see some technology where you're like, I bet that could solve some interesting problems? What are those problems? Like, what way do you and your team sort of approach ideating in these kind of new spaces?
Yeah, to me, it's an oscillation kind of back and forth between being problem-led and being tech-led. I think many times the inspiration comes from a tech, because you don't you can't really understand the potential of solving a problem until you sometimes see a tech. So for example, with the boating camera, we're doing a lot now with near infrared and thermal imaging. And I didn't know, like, I was a physics major. I didn't know a lot about a camera system that can see better than your eyes in the dark. And all the things that you can see with a thermal camera, like if you have a person overboard, they have a lot of thermal differentiation from the water. So it's a great way of recovering somebody. Or actually, we're looking for mammals like whales, so you don't hit a whale. Guess what you see when you boat close to a whale?
You see a lot of thermal, I'm hoping. But on the boat, you see nothing. Yeah.
You see their breath. Yeah. The breath is so voluminous and so warm that you see these big spouts of warmth in the air. So like that.
Interesting.
That was definitely like, I knew that the problem of not hitting whales or wildlife in the water was a problem, but it wasn't until I learned about thermal imaging that I realized like, oh, well, we could get a thermal imaging system and also put that in our camera system. So we could help solve the problem of, you know, people hitting wildlife when they're going too fast and they're foiling boats, for example.
That idea of sort of oscillating is fascinating to me because I feel like as we work with research teams and designers, I think people really like to categorize things and take these very strict approaches. And I like this idea of you can sort of move back and forth as you learn about a technology. That can be, you sort of put it in your interesting idea space, but then you oscillate over to a problem set you're working on, a sort of back and forth. I think that's a really good mindset. And I'm guessing a lot of our listeners could work within their teams to think about how to be more deliberate about that. Sort of do a little bit of what technology is out there that could potentially be interesting in our space. You sort of dive in and learn a little bit about it, but then quickly oscillate back to like, what problems do we work on solving for our users? I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, Andy, I think that my advice for the best way to kind of think about or a thought experiment to have is with a team, is you say, what would need to be true in order for this to be useful? Like, you can do a little bit of future casting. You can say, okay, so I see this new technology called e-ink. That's cool. Like, it doesn't require any battery power to power it. You know, it could be in an e-book reader. Maybe it could be a surface of a car or a refrigerator or something. But like, what would need to be true in order for that to be viable? Like, would it need to fall under a certain price point per square foot? Would it need to be color? Would it need to be higher contrast? Would it need to be, I don't know. But to me, I'm always, whenever I learn of a new thing or new capability, then I try to come up with this threshold moment where you say, wow, so AR glasses, like, they're big and wonky now. So how lightweight would they need to be before we have this tipping point? And I think that's one way to kind of frame your thinking around the readiness of various technologies.
A very useful framework for folks that are thinking about AI right now, what would need to be true to use AI for an application. And I think that would help people think about both upsides and downsides of those. We hear a lot of conversations about when is AI able to get it wrong. Well, that would vary a lot depending on the application. You could start to say, well, what would have to be true for it to be used in this application or another? I think that's a really good framework for design and product teams to really think through applicability and also how to revisit that applicability. One of the things we hear a lot of teams struggle with is when technology's early on in its adoption, often it's not ready for a use case, or we try and we learn from our users it's not ready. And then we say, well, that didn't work. And how do you pick that back up again and say, well, now maybe it will work? And I think that framework is a good way to do that, because now you can say, if one day this is true, we want to go back and revisit that technology. And I think that could be great framing for people that are trying to be early adopters as well.
You could even tee up projects that way. You could say, you know, if we go to a boat brand, for example, like Brunswick, and we say, hey, we'd like this to be on every Boston Whaler, you know, would you sign a letter of agreement that says, if it's less than $2,000 and if it catches any debris in the water, 99% of the debris at sea is in the water, like lobster buoys, within 50 meters of the boat. Yes. You know, so
yeah,
it's kind of almost like a conditional PO, but it's just getting them to think about, well, what would need to be true in order for us to adopt this?
Yeah, sort of a technology adoption framework that people can go through that solves real problems for users. I think that's a great idea. I think that's maybe a good ending point is we've sort of talked about some of these new technologies. And now, you know, not only have you gone through your book and the frameworks, which I think were great, also some thoughts on how people can evaluate how to oscillate between these two kind of tech-led and problem-led, but also then think about this sort of what would have to be true framework. So, David, I think this has been just fascinating and really interesting. I'm going to be watching Lookout as you continue to go through your evolution. I think it's a really neat product space, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you for coming on the show.
Me too, Andy. I appreciate your kind of iterative, humble approach to designing user experiences and testing. I think that takes a lot. There's a lot of that that's, as we all develop more intuition around spatial computing, I think a lot of iteration is required in early days.
I appreciate that.
If people are boaters, I'm excited for them to look at getalookout.com and give me feedback.
And where can we follow you? If people want to follow your thoughts and ideas and the things that you write, where's a great place to stay close to your work?
Yeah, I think supersite.world is where people can download first and last chapter of the book, their design principles, there's links to projects, and ways to reach me.
Excellent. All right. Well, I hope our listeners follow you in those places. Definitely check out your books. And again, thanks for being on the show.
Want to keep the conversation going? You can find the show notes at usertesting.com/podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. And if you enjoyed today's show, please share it with a friend or leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And until next time, this is Insights Unlocked, an original podcast from User Testing.